Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, I-17 northbound, the exit ramp at Greenway is restricted. On the 51 southbound, there's some debris on the roadway at Shea to watch out for, and an accident on the 51 northbound on the Greenway Road exit ramp. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon, looking for a high today of 96. Clear and breezy tonight. Overnight lows right around 70. It's sunny and 94 degrees right now.
A federal judge today found that Arizona prisoners continue to receive substandard health care. KJZZ's Will Stone reports the state must now come up with a plan to fix that by next month.
Over a year ago, the Department of Corrections settled a class action lawsuit with the American Civil Liberties Union, agreeing to rectify significant gaps in the quality of health care at state prisons. But according to the court, the agency's own monitoring shows that many of the issues persist. David Fonte with the ACLU says the settlement set the bar at 75% compliance, yet in some cases, that's still as low as 20 or 30%.
The findings of noncompliance span virtually every aspect of medical and mental health care, from medications to access to doctors and psychiatrists, laboratory tests, care for prisoners with chronic diseases.
Even when alerted about ongoing concerns, Fati says the Department of Corrections, quote, stubbornly maintained that it was in compliance with the settlement. That eventually led the ACLU to go back to court. Arizona now has until early June to bring forward a plan to remedy prisoner care. The Department of Corrections has not yet responded to a request for comment. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona's two U.S. senators are hailing what they call a, quote, touchdown for taxpayers. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, their celebration comes after the NFL gave the government money back.
The NFL says it's refunding more than $700,000 paid by the Defense Department to NFL clubs to honor military service members at league games and events. John McCain and Jeff Flake had complained the Pentagon spent more than $10 million in marketing and advertising contracts with professional sports teams between 2012 and 2015 for what the senators had dubbed paid patriotism. Flake and McCain called for an end to the taxpayer-funded practice of sponsoring such military celebrations at games, an effort that's often used for recruiting efforts and community outreach. A report they issued last year found 72 contracts in which the Pentagon paid for patriotic tributes at professional sports games. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
With apologies to Marketplace, let's do the numbers on the recently ended legislative session. 117 days, 374 new laws, 14 vetoes. Joining me to talk about some of the bills Governor Doug Ducey signed and some he turned away is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, lawmakers sent the governor a massive stack of bills over the last day or so of the session, and he wrapped up action on them yesterday. Are there any new laws that might have flown under the radar that you think may be particularly impactful to Arizonans?
Well, one of them that didn't get a lot of attention deals with the issue of auto insurance. Right now, as you know, if you want to drive on Arizona roads, you have to purchase auto insurance. Arizona has one of the toughest non-cancellation laws in the country that says, you know, unless you basically lose your license or you don't pay your premiums, they cannot cancel you. Now, you can certainly raise your rates. This gives insurers much more opportunity to simply say 45 days out from the end of your policy, yeah, we really don't want you anymore, and you've got to go out and go shopping. This could have some major impacts as people start getting these notices and have to go, you know, shopping around and looking for things. That one was mainly under the radar.
Governor Ducey has talked basically his entire term in office about trying to be pro-business and pro-growth in this state. And it seems like in the last couple of days, he signed a number of bills aimed at doing that.
Well, on the last day, he signed a number of bills that deal with deregulation. For example, the Industrial Commission used to regulate talent agents. Now, why did the Industrial Commission regulate talent agents? Well, because at one point there was a problem and somebody decided that if talent agents are ripping off their customers, somebody needs to be there to protect them. Well, the governors decided, well, we really don't need that. There are some bills to reduce taxes, some bills to consolidate several state agencies that are in there. And then there are things that are done under the term that we know better as a state. I mean, look at the number of preemption bills that were signed this year, including on the last day, the bill to say to Phoenix and Tempe, yes, you have an ordinance that says pet stores can only sell shelter and rescue animals, but we know better, and we're going to preempt that ordinance. and we're going to allow you to do some oversight of pet stores, but if they want to sell pets from commercial breeders, they're quite free to do so. There were other preemption bills, again, under the name of business. For example, the issue of guns and what cities can do on that. Airbnb, the fact that some cities have regulations saying we're not going to allow your neighbor to do short-term rentals. And in fact, I think the concern of the foes is not that your neighbor is going to have somebody on his couch for the weekend, but that some investors are going to buy up a series of homes and convert them into a de facto hotel without it being a hotel. As I say, there's a whole issue there in terms of state preemption.
Governor Ducey also vetoed some of the bills that were sent to him during this last week or so. Any that stood out to you as particularly important?
Well, some of these were more technical. You know, there was one dealing with the regulatory boards of health professions, some things on, you know, trademarks and stuff like that, information technology. A lot of these were more technical issues. Some of the bills that he vetoed were sort of, you know, funny in their own way. For example, there was a bill to say the next time we have an inaugural, one of the top four officials needs to be absent from the Capitol, sort of the way it is at the U.S. Capitol when the president gives his State of the Union
line
address,
of succession kind of members. Concerns.
Exactly. And the governor said, I don't think that's exactly necessary. There was a bill dealing with the taxation of gold and silver coins of collectors, and the governor said, I don't think so. And then there was an interesting mandate that required schools to teach cursive writing. And the governor said, while he's a big fan of people knowing cursive, he's not sure that this is something the legislature should be enacting on behalf of the State Board of Education.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
Well, we're all going to get a nice rest now from what damage the legislature can do to us.
If you sped by a deactivated speed camera in the last few months, the free ride is over. Photo enforcement cameras are turning back on across the valley after many were suspended for the last 2 months. Some cities had to turn off their red light and speed cameras after State Attorney General Mark Brnovich issued an opinion in March saying photo enforcement contractors have to be licensed as private investigators under state law. Now they're ready to operate. And the show's Lauren Gilger is here with more on this. So, Lauren, where can drivers look for these cameras on the roads?
So the Phoenix Police Department announced their cameras went back on Wednesday. Scottsdale's cameras restarted last week, and citations will start being issued in Chandler in June after they calibrate their cameras. And a lot of these photo enforcement programs have been around a long time, and they can cost you. In Scottsdale, fines for speeding start at about $250, and they're upwards of $300 if you run a red light. And Scottsdale police tell me just since they turned them on May 13th, their cameras have already captured 2,075 violations.
Wow.
Not every violation, though, turns into a citation. In Phoenix, for example, when the camera flashes, the violations are reviewed by Redflex. That's the company contracted to operate the photo enforcement program there. And then a police officer approves or declines the violation.
So, Lauren, obviously nobody likes being caught speeding and getting a ticket. But the big question is, do these cameras actually work?
That is the big question. So I asked that question of Michael Scott with ASU School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. He's also the director of the Center for Problem-Oriented Policing, and he looks at just about all of the research out there on issues like photo enforcement, so he can help police departments make decisions about it. So here's what he has to say.
It is almost evenly divided in opinion and factual conclusions about the effectiveness and the fairness of red light cameras.
But let's remember the goal of these programs is to reduce accidents. And he says overall, they help do that.
Overall, the analyses of many studies that have been done generally conclude that they do tend to have a positive effect in reducing vehicle crashes at intersections, especially the crashes that are most likely to get people killed and seriously injured. When those people crash, people end up in the hospital or in the morgue.
And when it comes to speed enforcement cameras, he says the evidence is even a little stronger that they help prevent crashes. But there is some offset. Scott says these cameras also tend to slightly increase the number of rear-end crashes as people stop real quickly to avoid getting flashed.
And why does he say they generally work?
That one's really simple. He said it's a deterrent.
They'll just tend to be a bit more cautious, if for no other reason than just to avoid getting that ticket.
But there's also a whole other side to this story.
But then there are a whole separate set of questions about whether this is a fair way for police to go about preventing crashes.
Right. So if they generally work, why do these cameras make people so angry?
Scott says there are a few different reasons for this. There's a question of whether it's fair to ticket the owner of a car when it's often not that person who's driving it when the camera caught them.
It's sort of like with a parking ticket. We don't know. We seldom know who parked the car there. All we know is that it's parked illegally and the owner of the car gets a ticket.
Then he says there's always a question of money.
Who gets that money and for what purpose? And in some communities, a lot of the money goes to a private firm, private company that owns and maintains the cameras. In other cities, a lot of the money goes to the local government. But some citizens just find it fundamentally unfair that lots of money would be raised on essentially depending on people breaking the law.
But most of all, Scott says there's a sense of Big Brother about this that just a lot of people really don't like.
Most people, I would say, have had the experience of being pulled over by a police officer for a violation that they know they committed, and they don't get a ticket. The officer gives them a warning and lets them go on their way. And that's something that was kind of built into the way in which we have come to expect that our police and our government operate. Sometimes we just catch a break. And that's part of, I think, what frustrates people about cameras. They're not very sympathetic.
That's Michael Scott with ASU's School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. He's also the director of the Center for Problem-Oriented Policing. And he's talking to us about the effectiveness and fairness of photo enforcement on the roads.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
Rural school districts are finding it hard to retain good teachers. In eastern Arizona, some school officials say part of the problem is that many of their new teachers are new to the area, too. But as KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, a few state university systems are hoping to improve those retention rates by helping small towns grow their own teachers, so to speak.
For Thatcher, Arizona resident Aubrey Larson, Friday night plans don't really change much from week to week.
Friday night, we kind of make a picnic on the family room floor. We have a movie that comes in from Netflix usually, and we eat pizza.
On the docket tonight,
we're going to watch Barbie and the Rockin' Royals.
Larson is the mother of three kids. She says her family is her first priority, but for the last 12 years, she's been slowly chipping away at her dream of becoming a math teacher.
The challenge standing in the way was there wasn't a program here.
For those not familiar with the geography in southeastern Arizona, Thatcher is located near the New Mexico border, which means the closest universities offering a secondary education degree are at least a two-hour drive away.
Traveling is not an option at all. I'm very focused on my family.
While schools in this area can successfully recruit teachers, many don't stay longer than a few years. Some say that has a lot to do with the realities of small-town living and the culture that comes with it.
Probably between 10 and 15% of teachers currently are from this area.
That's Jackie Hale. She works with Arizona State University's Mary Lou Fulton Teachers College.
If you've never experienced small town living and never experienced that you're going to drive 3 hours for a Target, all your doctor trips or whatever are going to be 3 hour trips. And one of the things that comes into play is that this whole valley is strong LDS.
That's Latter-day Saints. Mormon pioneers settled this part of Arizona, and the LDS culture is still a strong part of everyday life. Hale is part of a new program in Thatcher aimed at training teachers from here who want to work here. They've set up shop recently on the campus of Eastern Arizona College, and our local mom, Aubrey Larson, is one of the first students.
The program is geared towards people that have received an associate's degree in any area and then are interested in receiving a secondary education degree in math, English, science, or history.
Hale is wrapping up her first year in Thatcher right now, but ASU plans to expand this Grow Your Own idea over the next few years. In the fall of 2016, a similar program will be set up at Arizona Western College in Yuma and then Central Arizona College in 2017. ASU Teachers College Assistant Dean Connie Pengrazy says the concept is simple. More programs in more places means more teachers.
If you only have a handful of universities that are preparing teachers, then there are less teachers being prepared.
And ASU isn't alone in its use of this tactic. Here in the Gila Valley, Northern Arizona University offers a program for elementary education. The idea has been used in other states, too, like Montana and Indiana. That's according to John Hill, the executive director of the National Rural Education Association.
People that were born and raised in rural areas tend to be more comfortable in working in rural schools, and if employed in rural schools, they tend to stay there longer.
But, Hill adds, these programs aren't always a magic bullet.
It's more than just encouraging people to teach. It's encouraging people to teach in the shortage areas.
In the end, he says fewer people want to become a teacher these days in general, an issue that will eventually trickle down to school districts everywhere. As for Thatcher local Aubrey Larson, she's not quite ready to graduate yet, but she's already got a job lined up for when she does.
They're pretty desperate, so I'm lucky.
A year of student teaching is all that's standing in her way now to finally achieve her dream of becoming a math teacher. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, reporting from Thatcher, Arizona.
Some ballots are still left to be counted, but supporters of Proposition 123 have declared victory for the K-12 funding measure. A lawsuit has already been filed, and it may not be the only one. But Governor Doug Ducey says the win helps teachers and schools and moves the state in a positive direction. He also says he plans to keep the diverse group of supporters at the table.
And we're going to keep this coalition together, from the education community to the business community to the elected leadership in our state. And we're going to talk about how we continue to improve K-12 education.
Supporters of Prop 123 continually said throughout the campaign much more needs to be done to make that improvement a reality. And a lot of it centers on money. To dig in deeper, we've invited Andrew Morrill, president of the Arizona Education Association, and Matthew Ladner, senior advisor for the Foundation for Excellence in Education, to talk about it. And Matt, with the money from Prop 123, where will this put Arizona schools as far as the amount of money they get relative to what they actually need?
We've had a really rough decade over the last 10 years. There's a lot of people, some on my side of the fence ideologically, that perhaps don't appreciate that. There's been an actual decline in per pupil spending over the last decade. I think more broadly that the situation that we have here in Arizona is that we have an unusually small working age population, because we have a lot of elderly people and we have a lot of children, right? At any given time, it's your working age population that's sort of paying the bills of society, right? We're also not a very wealthy state, okay? So you put those two things together, Arizona is never going to rank up there with Connecticut with, you know, hedge fund billionaires and old money and all that sort of thing in terms of per capita spending. So I think the thing is to understand is that we spend more today than we did in past decades per pupil after you adjust for inflation. We also spend relatively low compared to other states, but all 50 states have gone up, right? The key, I think, and the sort of sensible center on all this is that we need to strive to have a system that will get the biggest possible bang for whatever bucks we can produce.
Yeah, Andrew, respond to Matt directly, and then I have a follow-up on that.
Matt is right. The state faces a lot of economic challenges. I think there are two different frameworks in the policy arena. One is sort of centered around what's possible, what budgetarily is feasible in a given year, and then you have folks like me out there and the people I represent that are in classrooms working with students saying, look, it's not enough. This can't go on. We want the best education system for our students. I would throw in, we need stability and certainty around our students. If we want to talk about market forces that are disruptors and force innovation, okay. Somewhere in the food chain, we can talk about that. Chaos and instability and uncertainty are not good for students.
Is there a philosophy that permeates the policymakers here where, you know, do we have districts so gerrymandered that regardless of what maybe a general populace thinks, you get down to brass tacks with individual lawmakers that they're not necessarily in favor of this sort of additional funding for traditional K-12 public schools? Are we running into that kind of wall? Is that real?
Yes, it is real. Matt is correct about the economic challenges that face the state. I would maintain that some of those have been man-made, less than natural disasters, but they're a combination of both over the last 20 years. But you just really hit on it. We have to agree that within the majority party in the legislature, there are now two camps, frankly, and it's a recent split, and it has not been closed. And there is a faction in our legislature, and we manage to elect them or allow them to be in office every year, that sees public education as any public enterprise suspicious. It's a cost to be contained rather than an investment to be encouraged.
Matt, when you talk about the legislature, obviously a lot of the school funding comes from a formula that lawmakers don't have a whole lot of say over. Is that the right approach? I mean, should there be some other way to do this? I mean, a lot of places go almost exclusively on property taxes. Is there another way that Arizona could be doing this?
The formula, I think, is not the problem. I think we should have a weighted formula, and it should give additional dollars to kids with disadvantages, like, you know, disabilities or English language learning and whatnot. The tax structure, however, is something I think we could bear to look at. Here in Arizona, it's not something that's a comfortable subject to bring up, but we actually have two population groups in the state that are capable of avoiding income taxation, right? One of them is paid in cash typically, and the other are part-time residents that we might call snowbirds. And so, you know, we might think about a more efficient tax system that would, you know, have everyone paying in. Everyone uses public services, right? We're all driving on the roads and benefiting from police protection and all these things. So, you know, a different type of tax system might be pro-growth, which is pro-revenue. And if you're, you know, pro-growth and revenue are hand in hand, you can't have one without the other.
And we're talking with Matthew Ladner, Senior Advisor for the Foundation for Excellence in Education, also Andrew Morrill, President of the Arizona Education Association. And Andrew, let me start with you on this one. Is there any way to improve the quality of Arizona schools without an additional influx of money?
Well, we don't have to imagine that. Matt and I probably disagree on some of this, but look, we've been the state with the largest cuts since 2008, 2009. Voters voted in 2000 inflation mechanism, and then we saw what life was like when that was denied. So we've lived through bare bones. We're one of the leanest states, administrative cost-wise, in the country. But to the heart of your question, you can always improve how you instruct. You can always learn more about the craft of teaching. Methodology, pedagogy, the way we teach can always improve. The thing is, although they are a unique business venture, school districts are a business. There's a deliverable world that has to do with the quality of the education we create, how we steward students, how we raise them to be civically engaged and ethically minded and academically proficient. But there's also a business operation world down below that, kind of below the surface. Contracts need to be written. Vendors are hired. One of the great things about spending money in public schools in Arizona is the money stays in Arizona, especially in our rural areas. They're one of the best employers and often the largest employer in an area. So we always have a responsibility to educate as well as we can, but we need an eager, interested funding partner, however we balance those revenue sources that Matt mentioned.
During the 2011 to 2015 period, the state that had the biggest fourth to eighth grade academic gains in the country on the nation's report card, which is the gold standard testing, was Arizona. We are actually, and this is underappreciated because some of the 1-2-3 conversation, there were kind of different flavors of opponents. One of the flavors of opponents were people who just flat out said, we don't want to give the schools more money. You know, the quote, the teachers,
right.
The teachers are being greedy. That was quoted, a direct quote from the yellow sheet. Okay. I think there's a path forward, a constructive path forward in increasing funding in relation to tangible results. So for instance, this last session, Governor Ducey called for, and it actually passed, a system for bonuses to schools when children earn college credit through AP exams and things like that. Kids should not be coming out of high school, in my opinion, without done one of two things, and maybe both of them. They need to either be prepared for success in college, right, or prepared for success in a career, right, or both, right? Both is okay because there's a lot of kids that go to college and it doesn't work out for them and they could have used a backup plan. I think if we took some constructive steps along those lines, we could overcome some of the skepticism that some corners of our state obviously feel. I think that is a path forward we could see to spend additional dollars, get them into the classroom, and get kids better prepared for success in life.
Andrew, do you think that Arizona schools and the education system in general suffers from a perception problem, both maybe at the state capitol, among residents of the state, and among residents of states outside of Arizona who look at what's going on here?
Absolutely. Look, we've known for some time that when people regard institutions, they tend to regard them unfavorably. When they regard people, their favorability goes way up. Public education is an enterprise. It's an institution. There's no doubt about that. But it's made up of individuals that are working and knocking themselves out. Parents and community members who see that, they want the best for those teachers. And remember, it's not just teachers, it's other roles. These people are leaving the profession they love right now in debt, in tears, and in droves. So obviously something is not working. I really appreciate what Matt said about where we should be putting our confidence when we look at what's happening in Arizona schools. I get a little uncomfortable about talking about differentiated funding for school systems because it's like trying to build a pyramid by starting in the middle. We aren't where we need to be with base level funding. And when we get there, or as we move and make progress in that direction, we can be talking about other kinds of funding scenarios, but you can't start with the nuances of how you're going to differentiate.
I think 123 is actually a great example of the center actually holding. And I'm hopeful that we can continue to make progress along these lines. It's very difficult. We have a polarized state. It really is. And the thing is that we need more excellent schools, whether they're district schools, charter schools, private schools, whatever. We need a better educated public. We're on the way there, but we're not there yet. There are constructive things that we can do on the funding front to accelerate our progress. But it's going to require more trust building and confidence building, and not just amongst, you know, political actors, but also in the public.
And gentlemen, we'll stop there. Matt Ladner and Andrew Morrill, thanks for the discussion, guys.
Thank you. Matt, good talking with you.
Good to talk to you.
Andrew Morrill is president of the Arizona Education Association, and Matthew Ladner is senior advisor for the Foundation for Excellence in Education.
It's the show for Friday. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Mark Brody.
And with John Hockenberry from The Takeaway, I'm Steve Goldstein. There are many examples, and you may have some yourself, of the unintended consequences of technology. Despite our best efforts to use technology for a beneficial purpose, platforms of big data are devoid of morality, and computers don't much care if you're an angel or arch-villain.
Take the actual case of the database and watchdog tool from ProPublica called Prescriber Checkup. By detailing the prescribing habits of hundreds of thousands of doctors across the country, ProPublica hoped journalists might have a comprehensive source and a tool for tracking the opioid and prescription painkiller epidemic.
Using Prescriber Checkup, Americans could select a responsible doctor who might responsibly prescribe opioids rather than one with a pattern of doling out painkillers with abandon. Well, ProPublica discovered that since the database started in 2013, some are using it to actually find doctors who would more willingly prescribe their drug of choice. Steve Engelberg is the editor-in-chief of ProPublica. He joins me now. My first comment is, this is what addicts do. They take advantage of things like this. Hello.
Yeah. No, I mean, our sort of goal in all this was a little bit broader. I mean, what we wanted to do, having obtained this Medicare data, was put up the prescribing habits of doctors of all kinds of medications so that one could do all kinds of research. I mean, one of the things that we were very interested in, for example, was we have a database of pharmaceutical company payments to doctors. And one of the great questions is, do payments influence the practice of medicine? Mm. And Big Pharma has always said, no, it doesn't. Well, until you had a database that looked at what a normal doctor in any given field does, you couldn't see whether they departed from the norm. So ultimately, what we did just this year was a story that looked at, okay, did doctors who get lots of payments tend to give more prescription drugs rather than generic? The answer was yes. So, you know, we had a sort of broad sense of how people would use this, and we believe that people did use it broadly. A narrower group, which is the opioid-seeking group, did turn out to use it in ways, we think, at least in some cases, that we did not intend.
Now, it's also the case that those users can lead law enforcement to perhaps find doctors who are contributing to the epidemic, if it indeed that is the case.
Right. I mean, one of the things that came out when we first did this, we identified the top 20 opioid sort of prescribers around the country. We discovered that a fairly large number, about half of them, were in trouble in various ways. Some of them had already been banned from Medicaid for abusive prescribing patterns, yet Medicare, another federal program, hadn't even looked. So one of the things that we felt would happen is that if we put this data up there, we would encourage federal authorities, regulators, law enforcement to take a closer look at something that was just being pretty much spent willy-nilly. And that did happen. So, you know, again, we felt like we had a lot of people using this for the purpose it was intended. And then as we discovered recently, some that were not.
How do you keep track of the way people use your database?
Well, it's a little bit unclear. You can't really tell the intent or motive of somebody coming to a website. Our analytics allow us to look at some of the web searches, and I have to say some of them were a little suspect, like, how do I find a doctor who will prescribe me anything? That seems like somebody who may not be looking for medical purposes. But it is true, and it's very important to emphasize, that people who are coming to this site have a potential mix of motives. We've had a sort of pendulum swing in the pain medication field, and today it's probably harder to get opioids than it used to. So what if you have chronic pain and you can't find a doctor who's willing to treat that? So I think some people use the website to find sort of legitimate treatment for legitimate problems. Other people are using it because they've become hooked and they're trying to abuse the drugs. And so our response was to try to put on each of the warning pages where this occurs a warning label explaining the sort of consequences of these drugs, the background of the epidemic, and so on.
Is this taking place outside of insurance? For instance, the Schedule I or Controlled Substances Act makes it difficult to get prescriptions on a greater frequency than insurance will reimburse. And so you can't, you know, upload or get multiple prescriptions because they're keeping track of all of that.
Yeah, I don't think we have clarity on what's happening at the end use phase. What we do know is that the amount of traffic on this particular news application is pretty heavy and, you know, a bit heavier than we would expect. And so, you know, by our very rough calculation, we're thinking that about 25% of the people coming to the site are looking for opioids. And of that group, some, maybe a majority, maybe not, you know, are looking to abuse it. How they do that, I think, is a reporting question, and it's the kind of thing we have been writing about over the years about this.
Can you tell how people are using prescription opioids versus the heroin actual crisis itself, people getting heroin off the street?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I do think we know from our reporting that people who are buying heroin often buy it because it's cheaper and easier to get than the prescription drugs. As you say, there are some things in the system now that prevent people from, you know, just openly abusing it, getting multiple prescriptions and so on.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Steven Engelberg is the editor-in-chief of ProPublica. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That's the Takeaways. John Hockenberry. In 1892, the U.S. government established a national parasite collection to learn more about diseases affecting livestock. 20 million specimens have now been transferred to the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History for safekeeping.
To get the story, the BBC's Jane O'Brien had to dip her toes into a swamp in Maryland.
Oh gosh, this is muddy.
Yeah, it's a little chilly too.
I'm on a leech hunt with the new curator of the National Parasite Collection, Anna Phillips.
Probably right in here is good.
We're hoping to find some bloodsuckers to add to the collection using our bare legs as bait.
So we just stand here and wait for the leeches to come and latch onto our legs.
Well, leeches that are blood feeding will be attracted by movement, so you have to do the leech dance. So there's a special technique. You can either do this a little bit, where you bounce your knees up and down, that creates some ripples. You can also do it side to side. The purpose is to create lots of ripples in the water, so if there's leeches farther away, they'll be attracted to this point.
The leech dance looks a bit like the self-conscious jiggling of middle-aged men at a wedding party. Needless to say, the leeches were not impressed.
Is that a leech there?
No, that's not a leech, that's plants.
Fortunately, the National Parasite Collection contains some 20 million specimens, including plenty of leeches. So, undaunted, we return to dry land.
This is the U.S. National Parasite Collection. It was founded in 1892. It contains mostly what were called helminths, intestinal parasites, intestinal worms. It also includes some protozoans, and it had a few ticks, fleas, and lice, and also a few mites.
The sheer scale of the collection is quite overwhelming. There's row upon row of jars and bottles of pickled parasites. Many are still attached to their unfortunate hosts, while others are so small they can only be seen under a microscope. Some of the parasites here can also infect humans.
Many of the specimens in this collection are from wildlife, and so looking back at these specimens and knowing which animals have hosted these parasites in the past, we can make predictions of what may be infecting humans in the future.
In fact, 60% of all human diseases come from animals. Stephen Higgs is the president of the American Society for Tropical Medicine and Hygiene.
A collection like this, it's a tremendous
resource of material for the genetics of these parasites to see what they were like and how they've changed, and enables people to apply more modern tools, molecular tools, for rapid identification of these parasites, which is obviously very, very critical.
But not all parasites are bad. Leeches, for instance, have significant medical benefits.
Leeches were used a lot in the 1700s and 1800s for treating all kinds of different diseases, everything from headaches to a cold. But now, today, we know that leeches have an anticoagulant that's in their saliva, and we have been able to isolate the proteins in those anticoagulants and then think about that and how that would be useful for creating anticoagulants for humans.
And that's why Anna Phillips continues to hunt for new species to add to the National Parasite Collection, scouring swamps and doing the leech dance.
The BBC's Jane O'Brien.
A citizens' committee in Peoria has recommended several projects to the city council to improve quality of life in the city, including a new rec center, open space acquisition, and public safety. And to pay for those items, the panel wants residents to increase the city's sales tax by 0.6 cents. Joining me to talk about this is former Peoria Mayor John Keegan, who chairs the Quality of Life Committee. And John, were there any themes of what residents in your city are looking for?
Well, Mark, the council had identified three areas they wanted us to look at, and that is open space preservation, parks and recreation, mainly looking at existing parks and how we can revitalize and rejuvenate them, and public safety. So that was really our charge. And through the course of meetings over the last about 5 months, we found that that really resonated with the citizens.
Among the recommendations, there are some recreation centers, some open space acquisition, more shade in parts of town. Are these the kinds of things that going in you thought the committee might be coming up with at the end?
We had really two areas. First of all, were the areas that had previously been identified by the staff and by the council, and then additional projects were identified by the committee.
I want to ask you about the recommendation that the committee put forward to pay for these projects, which is basically a 0.6 cent sales tax increase. And obviously, as a former elected official, you know that tax increases can be tricky sometimes. What was the discussion like that led to that particular recommendation?
We looked at traditional forms of public finance that have been available to cities, some of which have gone away, such as the Heritage Fund, and the city's ability to use impact fees has been greatly curtailed by the legislature in recent years, which really left three areas of public finance, and that is sales tax, property tax, and utility rates. Utility rates obviously don't apply to the projects that we were looking at here. We looked at property tax, and that's a fairly inflexible tax, and it's levied solely on the residents of the city. Sales tax has more flexibility with respect to how it's implemented, and it also has the advantage that it takes everybody that comes to the city, winter visitors for spring training, and people that come into the city to make major purchases also participate. So we felt that the sales tax was probably the most appropriate method to recommend to the council with respect to finance of these projects.
One of the concerns that leaders in other cities that have been discussing tax increases for various reasons have discussed is that, especially with a sales tax, if one city has it and another doesn't, folks, if they're going to buy a car, for example, will just go across the city line to another jurisdiction that doesn't have the tax. Are you concerned that Peoria might lose out on some sales if folks know that, hey, it's a little more expensive in Peoria than it might be in Glendale or in Surprise?
That was a major consideration for the committee. We looked at comparative tax rates compared to other communities within Maricopa County. What we found was, with respect to sales tax, Peoria has the lowest net tax in the West Valley, and probably in the bottom third valley-wide. And with respect to the total tax burden, which is, again, sales tax, property tax, and utility rates, in Maricopa County, we were third from the bottom. So we felt that by making the recommendation that we did, that we would still be well within the mean of other communities and would be able to put those resources to good use within the city of Peoria.
John Keegan is the former mayor of Peoria. He also chairs that city's Quality of Life Committee. John, thank you very much.
Mark, I appreciate it. I always enjoy an opportunity to talk about the city of Peoria.
For some of us, holes and scratches on the wall, debris on the floor, and hardware in the ceiling means a weekend to-do list. But at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, it's an exhibit. Permanent Collection Impermanent Museum is a look behind the scenes at how the building itself is affected by what's displayed inside it. I met Peter Bug, curator of programming at SMOCA, and Sarah Cochran, the museum's director and chief curator at the exhibit. We started by talking about something that had me looking for a broom and dustpan.
That sheetrock on the floor has been removed from the wall that's right above it, and you can see up there that it says Permanent Collection, Impermanent Museum. And that has been literally removed from the wall so that gallery goers can come and see that. That's the title of the show. And we've done that in order to allow them to see the layers of paint that have built up over time in this gallery. And then underneath those words, we've got four photographs that were taken in our other galleries where there has been sanded away layers of paint so that you can see these sort of concentric rings of the paint that has been used in past exhibitions.
It's almost like you're trying to bring the visitor behind the curtain a little bit about sort of how the museum functions.
Exactly. Not just that we collect objects and display them, but that we put a lot of time into making them look their best, both in the gallery setting and then just sort of by themselves in terms of how we choose to display them.
Sarah, when Peter came to you and said, I want to do this kind of exhibit where we basically show imperfections in the museum, what was your first thought about that?
I don't see them as imperfections. I see this as a very interesting exercise in thinking about the history and the physicality of the museum. I believe that this is a very radical show, and I think that one of the really exciting things that Peter brings up in this exhibition is the idea that the work of art physically changes the museum itself.
What does it do to the museum when you put up a new exhibit? Obviously, the exterior walls stay the same, and to an extent, some of the interior walls stay the same, but a lot changes from exhibit to exhibit, right?
And again, that's one of the premises of Peter's show, is that both curators and also the installation crew and even our registrar have to become instant experts on probably topics that the general public do not think are art-related. Last year for Post-Commodity, we had butterflies, and we had to figure out how to get, care for, and look after butterflies. But there have been many, many others, such as sand, such as getting oversized objects into the museum, how we hang a very heavy bell from the rafters. This is why the physicality of SMOCA is so important.
I think for a lot of people, when they imagine an exhibit being shown, they picture holes in the wall and maybe some scratches. And we've all hung photos on the wall and had them scratch the paint or things like that. But it seems like there's, when you're doing it on this scale and the kinds of things that you're displaying here, it's not just like little holes or maybe an anchor in the wall and some scratches.
Sure, yeah. No, we have hardware that's left in the ceiling from hanging this 200-plus pound bell. When there was a trailer in this very gallery a number of years ago, in order to get it in here, it had to come through the entire other side of the museum and come through the front area, and there was a scratch on the wall left from that. And the way that I think about these things is it's sort of like that place in your garage or in your basement where your parents put a mark for how tall you and your siblings and your friends were at various ages, where it's not something that you have it on the wall as a piece of art, but for the people who know where to look, it's something that they can enjoy and they can appreciate, and they can, you know, look back and say, oh, I remember when this happened, for whatever time that was.
I would think that over time, you probably could have had more of these, right? I mean, imagine some things probably just get repaired or fixed, and
yes,
people don't think of them as, well, yes, this could be part of a show sometime.
Absolutely. That when we made the original list, there were more items on it, but some of them had been fixed between the making the list or between when we thought about it and when we actually went to go and document it.
During the course of looking at all these different things around the museum, do you think that you will display exhibitions differently in the future, maybe install installations differently in the future, knowing sort of the impact that they have on the museum?
No. Our job is to push the museum to its limits, both intellectually and physically, and so we will not stop to do that. The pain for the museum is not about to stop physically. We look at these tiny little war scars as points of pride and just little happy moments when we remember some of the really amazing projects we've done in the past, and we look forward to doing that into the future.
I think for a lot of people, they see the things that you are showing off in this exhibition, and they see a to-do list. You see art in that.
I mean, maybe it's a little bit nostalgic. Maybe it's, like Sarah said, battle scars. But it's the sort of thing as, like looking at your knuckles and your shins and your elbows and saying, oh, yeah, that's when that thing happened. And maybe that wasn't the perfect way of doing it, but it was a lot of fun, and I learned something from it, and I'm better for it in the end.
That's Peter Bugg, curator of programs at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. We also heard from the museum's director and chief curator, Sarah Cochran. The exhibit, Permanent Collection, Impermanent Museum, is technically on display through the beginning of October. But since it's made up of stuff that's already been there for a while,
I would say that a lot of the marks will continue to be here until maybe they're covered up by another object or wall or another installation. But yeah, a lot of the markings will be left here for future audiences to enjoy.
And you'll presumably have new ones as well at some point.
I hope so, yes.
One man's trash is another man's treasure.
And one Chandler resident's trash is another's fashion statement.
The city's recycling center has asked residents to design fashion items, and while some fashion is considered trashy, this is actual trash. Out of trash and recyclables, then they'll showcase the designs in a runway show.
The contestants will then, the show's Annika Klein looks at this style exception.
The top is a birthday bag.
Farah Bodie is 11 and wants to be a fashion designer when she grows up.
The skirt is a poster board with napkins.
Well, I should say she's a fashion designer now. She created a two-piece outfit, complete with headband, for the Chandler Trash and Fashion Show.
And then we have a belt that is checkered with poster board that is white.
And it's not the first time she's turned household items into clothing.
Well, I was inspired by the unconventional challenge on Project Runway.
That's a reality TV show about fashion design.
I hate the unconventional challenge.
They put the designers in a weird place where you normally wouldn't make clothing, like a candy store.
Don't ever try hot gluing chocolate because it will melt. It was a disaster.
Farah loves using unconventional materials, whatever she finds around the house.
I like to get birthday bags or plastic bags and I make them in the shirts.
And she's good. You have to look twice to notice that this outfit is made of napkins and plastic.
The quality of the garments are really quite amazing.
Tracy Conaway is the City of Chandler recycling coordinator. This is the second year they've done trash and fashion, and the hope is it'll encourage people to think about reusing an item that they'd normally throw away.
Last year we had, for example, someone that took plastic bags and fused them through ironing, and it turns into a fabric.
Conaway says they're grabbing on to a trend of upcycling, or reusing an object to make something of even higher value. She says if they can get more people to reuse stuff in new ways, it's less waste for the city of Chandler to sort and ship elsewhere.
We had the napkins from a Halloween party. We had the birthday bag from past birthdays that we reused them for.
Now Farah says she could see her outfit being worn to a birthday party. This is where her mom, Laura, chimes in.
Like a party where you didn't have to sit down, right?
Yeah.
Because you can't actually sit down in this.
But if you spilled on the skirt, you would already have napkins to clean it up, right?
Yeah.
Perhaps the most practical use for this outfit is as a teaching tool. Here's Conaway.
Recycling is great and what you put in the blue bin, we find that really important, but we want people to literally think outside the blue bin and look at ways that they can give something around their house a new purpose.
Last year's show included 9 designers, and Conaway says this year they're expecting more than 20. To compete for prizes like gift certificates. Oh, and if you're wondering who will wear Farah's ensemble on the runway, turns out she models too. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.